It is a great pleasure to welcome back to Wide Moat Investing Summit, Hunter Hayes, Portfolio Manager at Intrepid Capital Management. Before joining Intrepid Capital, Hunter was an associate on the high yield team at Eaton Vance and a consultant at Deloitte Advisory. Hunter graduated from Auburn University with a BSBA degree in finance and a BM degree in piano performance. Besides his passion for value investing, he's also an avid runner and also finished the first Boston Marathon. I think now it's a year or so ago, Hunter. And I don't know if you have another one planned, but good luck if you do.
Whenever they start letting us run again, for sure.
Exactly.
They can't participate.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I very much look forward to your presentation today. So I will defer to you now, and I'll be back for the Q&A at the end. Please go ahead.
Thanks, John. I appreciate the introduction, and I've been looking forward to this discussion. Hopefully after my presentation, I'll have a chance to interact with some other members of the MOI global community so we can keep the conversation going. I got some great feedback last year and had some really good conversations following the presentation. So before we start, I have some standard disclosures. You know, I won't bore everyone by reading through all of them, but I just want to point everyone's attention to these. We do own position and take two stock in several of our strategies. So about me, you know, like John said, I'm a portfolio manager at Intrepid Capital Management. We're based in Jacksonville Beach, like I'll talk about in a minute. Everyone on the research side here is a generalist, you know, which means we're not sector constrained or even asset class constrained. So I get to work on both the debt and the equity side. I get to look at a lot of interesting stuff across various industries, and you know, we think this broad approach gives us an advantage in the way that we're able to look at the world. Before Intrepid, I worked on the high yield investments team in Boston at Eaton Vance. And before that, I was a consultant at Deloitte, focused on business valuation. And I went to school at Auburn, which is in the state of Alabama, before I moved up to Boston, like a whole different world. So as a Southerner from a smaller city, I'd like to think I have a bit of a differentiated viewpoint than a lot of other investors. So briefly, you know, Intrepid, founded in 1995 by a father-son team. The goal was to participate with the market on the upside and protect on the downside. You know, we have a very careful, fundamental value investing process. And our philosophy really hasn't changed that much over the past quarter century. We're still focused on finding strong businesses with steady, reliable growth, almost always with robust free cash flow generation, although, you know, sometimes with free cash flow generation in sight, since a lot of companies these days are not as focused on free cash flow generation right now, with rates as low as they are. And, you know, we normally look to buy things when they're trading at a greater than, you know, 20% discount to our estimate of intrinsic value. And obviously, we spend a lot of time internally sort of figuring out what is that estimate of intrinsic value and debating it out. And like I mentioned, we're based in Jacksonville Beach, Florida, so kind of removed from the financial market hubs right next to the beach. You know, we view it as an advantage in terms of being able to avoid a lot of the noise, a lot of the conferences, a lot of the hubbub, and focus on the signal. So my wide mode investment idea I want to discuss today is the U.S.-based video game publisher Take-Two. It's the same investment that I presented last year. So a little boring and unoriginal, but my estimation is that the moat has actually widened on this since. I thought it was a great candidate to discuss, you know, especially in light of the COVID-19 pandemic, which has obviously brought a lot of challenges globally and forced people to stay at home. You know, video games have been a really safe and low-cost form of entertainment during this difficult time and allowed companies like Take-Two, publishers like Take-Two to shine. Engagement and Take-Two's core franchises has been phenomenal. You know, I think I saw a report a couple months ago where Verizon said video game usage during peak hours in March was up 75%. And it makes total sense, right? I mean, people are stuck at home, don't want to go outside, want to social distance. Video games are kind of logical. The question today is, you know, once the quarantine is lifted, once life gets back to normal, which is hopefully sometime soon, you know, how much will this increased engagement subside? And I'll touch on that a little bit more later on. Here's a graph showing Take Two stock price since I presented here last year to the day. Now, before I presented, the stock had already run up a little bit from the 80s, and we initially started to nibble at it in the 90s, but it's been a pretty good year for the equity, about on par with the NASDAQ. I had to double check when I saw the NASDAQ's actually been up in the 20s, you know, since June 24th of last year, which is pretty insane. But, you know, Take-Two really did, over the past few months, become kind of a hot quarantine trade. A lot of new money came in, a lot of hedge fund money, you know, colloquially kind of became a bit of a hedge fund hotel, and, you know, it's created a lot of volatility in the stock that wasn't there as much before. You know, and past all that short-term noise, I still believe more than ever that Take-Two will continue to compound our capital, and it's set up for continued shareholder value creation. You know, I saw a chart actually a couple days ago on Twitter that showed the top 10 best performing S&P 500 stocks over the last decade, and Take-Two was on that list. So it's already had a great run, but I think it has the potential for another great decade. And here's why. So the thesis that I presented last year is really still intact. You know, the anchor for the thesis is really the fantastic, engaging, and engrossing intellectual property. So Take-Two owns, and in some cases licenses, some of the best-selling entertainment series of all time. You know, you've probably heard of a lot of these. Grand Theft Auto, Red Dead Redemption, Borderlands, NBA 2K. The games are played across a variety of platforms, you know, like PCs, mobile devices, but mainly on consoles like Xbox or, you know, the new PlayStation 5 that comes out later this year. You know, for the last 12 months, booking through consoles was around 75%. So predominantly consoles. And as a reminder, you know, just some accounting housekeeping, I like to look at Take-Two's net bookings versus GAAP defined net revenue. Just because net bookings includes the deferred revenue, there's a lot of accounting assumptions in the weeds there. But anyway, some of Take-Two's games come out with sequels. Others have longer cycles that are constantly kept updated with fresh content, keeps players engaged. And these games are just enormously popular. You know, Grand Theft Auto and Red Dead Redemption, which Take-Two owns all the IP for, had over 100 million active unique players during their fiscal 2020, which just ended. That's a phenomenal number. Additionally, Take-Two experienced management team aligned with shareholders. Strauss, the CEO and chairman, Strauss Zelnick owns a significant amount of the stock. Developers of the games are also paid a lot of their salary in stock-based comp, which creates this nice aligned structure, even though I'm not a fan of the dilution as a shareholder. And Take-Two is growing quickly, you know, even relative to the backdrop of the fast-growing video game industry. It's doing so, you know, without recklessly borrowing money like a lot of other companies are, or pouring too much capital back into the business. You know, returns on invested capital are still over 20% by my calculations. And the company has no debt. And a $2 billion cash buffer to go along with their $16 billion market cap. And lastly, you know, Take-Two still characterized by these lumpy cash flows that entertainment businesses are often marked by. You know, I believe some of that lumpiness will continue to be mitigated by some ancillary revenue streams going forward. You know, you saw the realization of some of that over the past year. As well as the potential evolution of some alternative gaming platforms, you know, like streaming, which I talked about last year and which started to manifest itself a little bit over the past few months, services like Google Stadia. You know, Take-Two gave a cornucopia of new information on our last earnings call related to its pipeline. And that's really what's ultimately going to be the biggest catalyst for smoothing cash flows, just more content, more games. You know, the biggest difference between Take-Two and the two bigger U.S. publishers, Activision and EA, is just size. Size, content, releases, and pipeline. And Take Two is starting to catch up. Historically, their emphasis has been more on quality, and you know, now they're reaching the scale where they can kind of merge the quality with the quantity of content. So you know, I don't want to give an earnings update necessarily, but I did want to highlight, you know, the 4Q20 earnings, which ended 331, were just absolutely astonishing. Even in light of the stay-at-home orders and the quarantine, this was supposed to be a sleepy quarter for Take Two, kind of a flat year-over-year quarter, no new IP coming out, you know, nothing exciting, kind of a build-up quarter for a slate that is really going to hit stride over the next few years. And yet net bookings came in almost 50% higher year over year. EBITDA margins rose when they were actually supposed to contract, just kind of highlighting the operating leverage inherent in the business. I mentioned the balance sheet, you know, engagement in the titles, which is ultimately what drives more engagement. You know, this is sort of that engagement begets engagement model. And really, you know, most astonishing to me is just the GTA 5 Warhorse continues to deliver. Still arguably the best-selling entertainment product of all time. I mean, 130 million units, that's absurd. You know, they're it's hard to find. I've seen it claimed on the internet that it's the greatest entertainment product of all time, and it's hard to find anything, really anything, that's sold over 130 million units. And you know, you go on Twitch, right, which is a service, Amazon-owned service, where you can watch people play video games. And at any time, there are still hundreds of thousands of people watching people play this game. People watching people play the game. You know, for non-gamers, that's kind of a novel concept. In fact, right before dialing in for this, John, I logged on and there were 211,000 people watching other people play the game. And it's one of the most watched games. It's really special when a company can create a franchise that endures like this. I mean, 7 years in video game years is a century. You know, additionally, Epic, which owns Fortnite but also has its own gaming platform, made GTA 5 free in May. It crashed their whole store. The storefront was down for almost an entire day. And I took that to mean the company is at least starting to think about GTA 6 and trying to kind of usher in the last wave of cost-conscious consumers. But, you know, they released their 10K. Recently, which kind of made me think differently on GTA 6. They disclosed marketing spend in the 10K, and it looks like it's expected to spike in 2023, which a lot of people took to mean, you know, that's going to be when they push through a new big title like GTA 6. But we'll see. I mean, for now, all I know is engagement in GTA 5 is continuing to get better 7 years after release, and it's tough to imagine a better scenario than that. And the company announced a new slate of games, you know, a pipeline that they really haven't given transparency into ever. So that's pretty exciting, and I'll talk about that more later. You know, I walked through this slide last time I presented, but I wanted to revisit it. You know, the intellectual property at Take-Two, it's top-notch. You know, it starts with the 4,000-strong base of R&D staff, you know, that contribute to the creation of the content. And these developers work on a lot of different teams and are sort of the lifeblood of the Take-Two organization. We spent a lot of time talking to some of the developers that have worked at Rockstar and 2K and just understanding the culture of excellence there. And, you know, I can't overstate the importance of human capital in this business, which is hard to quantify. The world's best video game designers, you know, like the world's best athletes, are really well known in gaming communities. You know, creating blockbuster video games is a really highly specialized niche task. It requires a lot of proficiency, a lot of programming proficiency, organization, and talent. You know, some of these games take a decade to incubate, you know, soup to nuts to make. So I just want to highlight the importance of having a well-run, tenured team in place, you know, as sort of a barrier to entry for a lot of other big companies that have tried to make video games. So Take-Two has a few company-owned studios or labels. I mentioned Rockstar, it's kind of the crown jewel, 2K Games, Private Division. You know, Rockstar publishes Red Dead Redemption and Grand Theft Auto, collectively have sold hundreds of millions of copies, and they own all the exclusive rights to that IP, which is really important. Don't license any of that IP. 2K, which publishes NBA 2K, which accounted for, you know, almost a third of Take-Two's net bookings this past quarter. You know, they push out other popular titles as well. 2K pushed out other popular titles as well, like Borderlands, which also released a game this past year, WWE, Civilization, but they pay licensing fees on a lot of that, so they don't own some of the IP. The Borderlands game I just mentioned, you know, came out this past year, had great acclaim, was the biggest release they had, biggest non-annual title release they had. Sold over 10 million copies, you know, beat expectations handily for high single digits, and did over 50% more copies than the last installment did over the same period. So kind of raising the benchmark every time they release a new version of that game. And then the last label I want to highlight is just Private Division. And I talked a little bit about it last time. You know, this is the indie studio within Take-Two. It's dedicated to bringing titles from top independent developers to market. So a few years old now, had some games coming out this year. In fact, Disintegration was the big title they were talking about. Came out about a week ago, and it's done fine so far. You know, I think of this more as sort of a call option embedded in the business. It could pay off handsomely, you know, if it ever develops a blockbuster franchise, a GTA or a Red Dead Redemption type franchise, but it's not there yet. You know, Take-Two also owns a mobile game developer called Social Point. It spent about $250 million in 2017 to buy them. It only makes up single digits of bookings right now, but it could grow substantially too, you know, along with the sort of fast growing mobile game category. You know, so Take-Two has great developers, and you know, they really employ them efficiently. I want to mention too, if you compare Take-Two versus some of the other big video game publishers, not just domestically, but internationally, take Ubisoft, a French video game publisher. You know, they have sort of three times the headcount of Take-Two and yet lower net bookings. You know, so these developers, they work, you know, for these really well thought of studios that are considered best in class by players of the games under the Take-Two umbrella. So each one is assigned to, you know, to her own label. And then these studios, these labels, create and fortify the brands, you know, getting back to this, you know, sort of a virtuous cycle. And Take-Two owns the IP rights to, you know, almost 30 of these unique brands. So there's just tremendous network effects going on, you know, perpetuated by the human capital element that really is Take-Two's engine. You know, these games attract additional users, it adds incremental value to the current users, and then adds value to the whole ecosystem of the game. So, you know, I really just want to drive home the point that the engagement begets engagement. And there's some really incredible scale effects that happen here. So there's a lot of stuff I could talk about on the network effect topic, but the bottom line is that scale matters. You know, established brands like Grand Theft Auto and Red Dead Redemption from the Rockstar studio, they more easily attract gamers because they know Rockstar designs quality intellectual property, and the experience will be top notch. And building that reputation, building that experience, you know, that endorphin rush a player gets when they open the Rockstar application, you know, that's taken money, skill, and time. And then once the game hits a critical mass, you have that online community with a lot of user-generated content, and it makes it worth playing for the other incremental gamers who get to build off that. So the engagement begets engagement. You know, I've probably said that five times, and I'll probably say it five more times. It's a great model. The last thing I'll mention on this slide, you know, Metacritic reviews tend to correlate pretty strongly with sales, with game sales. So if you want to know the quality of Take-Two's IP, just go look at some of the Metacritic ratings, especially compared to the other big studios. You know, Take-Two, I think, has two or three of the five best-rated games of all time on Metacritic. Okay, so the pipeline. You know, Take-Two has 93 titles planned for release over the next 5 years, which is a massive number. You know, I don't contextualize it on this slide, but that's significantly more games than they've released over the past decade. You know, so the next fiscal year 2021, which again ends 3/31 of next year, it's going to be a light release year. You know, I think fiscal 21 is only about 13% of that 5 year pipeline. So 81 or so of those games are going to be the 4 years following that, which is just going to be a deluge of content. And it's really going to help smooth out the company's historically lumpy earnings profile. You know, they're going to get more at-bats. It's a hits-driven business, and at-bats are kind of what matter, you know, as long as you have a good average. Management's kind of reiterated their desire to release, or to try and release, at least one blockbuster title a year, too, which historically, you know, it's been, they've had gaps. They've had 2, 3, 4 year gaps, which, you know, create 1 year where they have just phenomenal amounts of cash flow generation, and other years, you know, they're kind of treading water, which in their case, it's still good cash flow generation, just not as phenomenal as the year where a Red Dead Redemption 2 gets released. And so with the new consoles coming out later this year, you know, the new Sony console and the new Microsoft Xbox console, there's going to be more gamers in the ecosystem than ever before. So I'm really excited about the way this content's going to be received. You know, and over on the left-hand side of this slide, I just thought it was funny. Elon Musk tweeted this picture recently, I think just last week, which is meant to show Take-Two just squeezing the last drops out of GTA 5. You know, I should say a lot of gamers were disappointed that GTA 6 will not come out with the new console. New consoles come out later this year. GTA 6 will not come out later this year. You know, if you look back historically, though, Take-Two's always waited at least a few months after a new console release to release a big blockbuster game. You know, and they've laid out their reasons at conferences before, too. They've said, you know, one, you have a lot of clutter of new games when these new systems drop. For instance, you know, there's a Polish game studio, gaming publisher, CD Projekt Red, that's coming out with a massive game that they've been working on for almost a decade called Cyberpunk 2077. It's supposed to be really well received. You know, and by releasing a game that's in a similar genre, like a GTA 6, you could just cannibalize your sales. You know, by waiting a few months, the company can really maximize its user engagement. And the other point that they've made is just not everyone gets a new console right when they come out. You know, a lot of people wait a few months after they come out. There's typically shortages to kind of create some pent-up demand. So by releasing a few months after, or 6 months or a year after the consoles come out, they can reach more users. And you know, that's one refrain you hear constantly from Take-Two management. If you listen to the earnings calls, you know, really what they get at is we're trying to maximize the amount of people, you know, that we're able to reach, and find the distribution platforms and the methods to get to as many people as possible, because we know our content is good, is what they've said over and over again. It's just a matter of getting in front of the right people and maximizing engagement. You know, I talked a lot about management last time. They're great. Strauss is awesome. They're also paid really well, you know, but I believe they have appropriate incentives, you know, aimed at hitting profitability goals, growing recurrent consumer spending, which, you know, to me is sort of the annuity portion of this company, right? The reliable cash stream portion that you can value consistently, and then treat everything else as a little more variable. So very important. One thing I will touch on, and I don't have any points in the slide on it, but I'll talk about it a little bit, is the departure of an important creative principal at Take-Two back in February, Dan Houser. So Dan was influential in building some of Rockstar's best intellectual property. And when it was announced he was leaving back in February, the stock sold down quite a bit, which we saw as an attractive entry point. Of course, we didn't know, you know, COVID-19 would hit, you know, later in March, and people would be forced to stay at home and drive user engagement. We didn't have that sort of foresight, but it did turn out to be a pretty good entry point. So, you know, curious about the true extent of Dan's impact, I went back and reviewed complaints, publicly accessible complaints filed by former employees against Take-Two. And these public filings offer some valuable insights into the operations of Take-Two's really opaque studios. So I was specifically looking for details on Dan and his role at Rockstar. So another employee of Take-Two, one of the original founders, along with Dan and Dan's brother Sam, Leslie Benzies, paints kind of an unflattering picture of Rockstar in this complaint. He's the one that's suing Rockstar. So his complaint alleges that he was the creative genius behind Grand Theft Auto, and that Sam, who again is Dan's brother, Dan's the one that's leaving, was the only remaining Rockstar principal who was worth anything. So, you know, from his complaint, I gleaned a lot about, you know, Dan's role, and how the Hauser brothers collectively, sort of worked on the operational side. So the billion-dollar question was, you know, how big of an impact can one or two creative talents, someone like Dan, or Leslie or Sam, have on the prospects of a 2,000-employee video game studio in Rockstar? So I'll try and offer some perspective on that. So Ben Vies, who made the complaint, had been out of the company since 2014, right? Shortly after Grand Theft Auto V was released. And since then, as I've talked about incessantly, Grand Theft Auto V has gone on to shatter records for continued user engagement. And a lot of that is in part, you know, due to additional content that was created and published after Ben Vies' departure. So in 2018, Rockstar released another massive hit, Red Dead Redemption 2, received top marks from critics and broke sales records. And that happened nearly 4 years after Ben Vies left. So it may be true, you know, that Ben Vies was instrumental in creating the Grand Theft Auto universe and maybe even elements of Red Dead Redemption. But it's also evident, you know, that Rockstar did not really suffer in terms of content quality or fidelity or unit sales of new titles since he left, not to take anything away from his creative genius. So similarly, you know, Dan Hauser had been on leave since last spring of 2019. And really since then, Grand Theft Auto had continued to shatter records, you know, thanks again in part to well-received content releases. They came out with a release called The Diamond Casino Heist last summer that broke records for engagement, and the launch of Red Dead Online, which were both published after Dan took that leave. So I'm sure there are some internal adjustments being made at Rockstar in light of Dan's departure, just as there were likely, you know, some adjustments being made after Ben Vies' termination. But Rockstar is a publishing powerhouse, and it attracts the best and the best in terms of talent and creative vision. So I do think, you know, there were a lot of headlines after Dan left about, you know, Rockstar's downfall, you know, will Rockstar ever be the same? The culture's changed. And you know what? The culture has changed. Video game publishers, labels specifically, have had a bad rep for years for overworking people. You know, over the past couple months, there have been a lot of headlines and a lot of allegations about sexual misconduct at video game companies. You know, it's kind of been a spotlight industry for excess and for, you know, some inappropriate behavior. So, you know, Rockstar has had to clean up their act, and it is changing. The culture is improving. So the market's going to be really keenly focused on how Rockstar's next big title performs, you know, how this new culture and what I think of as a better culture is gonna perform compared to the legacy culture. You know, and I would expect, given sort of the historical cadence of Rockstar releases, that we will get an announcement of a new Rockstar title sometime over the next 6 or 12 months. And the market's gonna be really, really keenly focused on that. So, you know, moving on from management, you know, Take-Two is growing really quickly. You know, net bookings have grown at a double-digit CAGR over the past 5 years. Recurrent consumer spending, which I talked about earlier, has grown at a 30% CAGR. That's the annuity stream of the business. EBITDA margins, which you know, I add back deferred revenue, you know, have grown from 19% to the high 20s over the past couple years, which is still 5% below where peers like Activision and EA are. They have margins in the mid to high 30s. You know, a lot of this growth has been from industry trends, you know, things like the shift from physical sales to digital sales. But some of it has also come from increased scale, you know, on the operating side. And I think there's a lot of room to run there, you know, to get into the mid 30s, like some of the Take-Two's peers. You know, other tailwinds for margins that should benefit all video game publishers are the possibility of decreased platform fees, and an increasing percentage of revenue from microtransactions, you know, which carry very, very high margins, 70 or 80% margins, so contribute a lot. You know, I've talked about how historically cash flow has been lumpy. You know, although the company hasn't burned cash at any point over the past 5 years, the lumpiness has been tough to stomach, you know, for a lot of shareholders. So I think the management team, and you can see this in the incentive plan, the new proxy hasn't come out yet, but in last year's incentive plan, you know, RCS is front and center, and growing that consistent cash flow generation is really important to the management team. And just on the recurrent consumer spending, you know, it's kind of the video game equivalent of the same store sales, right? It's generated through, you know, for the most part, microtransactions, which I kind of segment into virtual currency, add-on content, and in-game purchases. So for those who aren't gamers, you know, these microtransactions are essentially additional content, right, that a gamer purchases after buying the initial game. So the type of virtual content can vary. It could be, you know, a new mission or a new character in a game. And I read the other day that one of the hottest items in some video games right now are virtual face masks for your characters. You know, people are actually shelling out, you know, $2-3 online to have their virtual avatar have a mask. So you know, things like this, and the margins on those purchases are you know, just fantastic, since there's very little incremental cost associated with that virtual content. You know, and the RCS, going back to the engagement begets engagement battle cry, you know, it keeps gamers engaged well past that initial release. You know, it's one of the reasons that a franchise like Grand Theft Auto has stayed relevant for so long, because players keep coming back to this ecosystem, to this, really this world, this society that they've created. So, you know, Take-Two has a broader publishing base today than it's ever had. You know, across its four labels, it's coming out with a constant stream of new titles, you know, regular cycle releases, going back to that really robust pipeline, the 93 games, you know, the games are lasting longer than before, especially the sort of games that Rockstar and 2K publish. So all of this is going to contribute to RCS going forward and help smooth out that free cash flow. You know, and this slide kind of shows, you know, the lumpiness of the free cash flow. A year like 2019, where Red Dead Redemption came out, was a really, you know, cash generative year for the company. If we went back further and looked at, you know, the year Grand Theft Auto 5 came out, it was similar. And I would expect to see another big increase when Grand Theft Auto 6 comes out. But eventually this should start to smooth out, you know, as more and more content releases are normalized for the company. And if you look at someone like Activision or EA, the cash flow profile is a lot smoother, although it is still lumpy because it is still hits driven. So I changed one or two charts in this slide, but I included something similar to this last time. You know, just the video game industry is an awesome industry to have as a tailwind. You know, there's something like 2.5 billion gamers across the world, according to the Entertainment Software Association. And the ESA provides some other interesting data that I highlight in this slide. You know, global game sales have grown at a low teens 10-year CAGR over the past decade. And we expect it to continue growing in the high single digits, at least going forward. There's a lot of white space. You know, a lot of areas of the world where gaming is not ubiquitous yet, where we would expect it to continue growing. And, you know, as these charts on the right also highlight, most gaming is done on PCs and smartphones, which means there's also a lot of white space for a publisher like Take-Two, who currently generates a good portion of their bookings on consoles, you know, the majority of their bookings on consoles. So I won't spend much time, you know, talking about some of the hot buzzwords that you might see headlines about, you know, things like virtual reality or esports, although Take-Two is involved in both and could benefit from both. But I want to instead talk briefly about monetization, distribution, and international expansion, because I think those are the three avenues that are probably easiest to gauge sources of top line and bottom line growth for Take-Two going forward. So, you know, monetization wise, the industry is still going through a change. You know, there's been a rise really over the past 3-4 years in the popularity of free-to-play games, you know, games like Fortnite. And those games have reached a critical mass, you know, I mentioned earlier, by making their games entirely free to download, then charging these microtransactions, right? That's how the players stay engaged, and that's how companies like Epic, who make Fortnite, make their money. You know, oftentimes a very small percentage of the users make up, you know, over 95% of the bookings for these games. So it's very dependent on a select number of users to drive profitability. And that model was originated in the mobile game space, right? Games like Clash of Clans, you know, which John asked me about last time, you know, did a great job of monetizing a small user base and sort of paying for the entire content experience. But Fortnite made it mainstream with PC and console games. So, you know, other than its mobile titles, Take-Two doesn't have any free-to-play games yet. I mean, the company did disclose when talking about the upcoming pipeline, the 93 games, that 26 of those are going to be free-to-play. Some of those will be mobile. You know, but at the end of the day, I'm not worried about the monetization model because it's really the quality of content, not the monetization model, that's the most important ingredient for a successful video game and for a successful video game publisher. The other monetization model that's been floated around and, you know, last year was getting some traction was the sort of Netflix model for video games, you know, similar to how Netflix really took off when they transitioned from mail delivery of DVDs to digital streaming. You know, video game streaming services are finally becoming practical, you know, in large part thanks to faster internet speeds and better hardware. You know, who knows? Google Stadia came out this past year. It's largely been a bust. I actually thought it was going to do better than it did. New consoles may be the catalyst for more and more people streaming games, as will 5G potentially if and when that happens. But we'll see. You know, what's important is Take-Two wins with streaming or without streaming. You know, the biggest benefit with streaming is they probably have a wider audience than they would sell software to otherwise. You know, they probably also benefit from the absence of a console royalty. You know, they pay royalties to Sony or Microsoft for the platforms. But this could be offset, you know, by distribution fees paid to a streaming service provider. So, you know, all things equal, it may not be that much different. You know, I'm definitely skeptical of a Netflix model for gaming. The customer value proposition I went into last time, you know, just has to do with the nature of the video game content, right? Most video games played for 150 hours. You know, when you do the math, consumers pay more for the video game in a subscription model per hour than just buying the title outright. You know, I kind of walked through an example last time. I won't walk through the entire example again. But you know, going back to distribution, one last benefit I'll mention for Take-Two stems from the competitiveness that's still in the platform space for video games right now. You know, the way that people play the games on PC. Publishers pay platforms a cut of the sales generated through storefronts. Similar to, you know, kind of the controversy that's going on with Apple right now around paying a percentage of your sales to the App Store for the right to use their storefront. It's the same thing on the video game side. So for the longest time, the de facto take rate has been, you know, 30%. But Epic Games, maker of Fortnite, recently changed changed their take rate for their store to 12%. They announced they were going to do that last year and followed through with it. And Take-Two has done some exclusives on Epic, you know, like Borderlands 3, which beat the sales forecasts. So we think that the take rate change is going to make a big difference for margins and for demand because a lot of games were not being sold on stores like Epic or Steam because of the take rate. 30% is a lot to give up. 12% is a lot to give up, and you know, that should start to change over time. But the last thing that I'll mention on this, and I apologize, I just remembered one more thing I wanted to mention is just the geographic tailwind. You know, global internet penetration around the world has grown significantly over the past decade, should continue to grow. That increases the pool of content consumers and potential gamers have access to. You know, Western content, as Netflix has sort of proven out, really in most forms, tends to sell well around the world. So it's just a question of distributing it, and more internet penetration helps with that. You know, this to me really just captures Take-Two's moat really concisely. Strauss lays it out pretty well. You know, I'd sum it up as, you know, we're invested in Take-Two for the people, for the IP, and for the brands. You know, and I think there are pretty big moats around all three of those. You know, what makes that moat so difficult to cross? You know, building competing brands in any established industry is a hard body of water to swim across, right? Like if you think about any of the world's most valuable companies, nearly all of them have significant brand value. And well-regarded brands like Take-Two scales with consumers, it makes switching costs very high. And that's not to say that if Take-Two, you know, started releasing terrible games, people would continue playing them. You know, they have to prove themselves with every release. But I would argue that, you know, when Google, Amazon, or Apple release a phenomenal game, you know, if it is truly phenomenal, it would still take times for gamers to fall in love with it, no matter how great it was. And that's just because there are huge costs to building that ecosystem. You know, if you've logged a couple hundred hours in a game and spent hundreds of dollars on microtransactions and formed meaningful bonds and friendships with other players in that game, you don't just up and leave as soon as the next thing comes out. You know, otherwise, Grand Theft Auto V would never have had the 7-year run it's had. So with every new gamer that comes into the ecosystem, I think that mode widens and really sets up well for the next iteration of the franchise, as long as you can keep delivering on content. So as long as Take-Two prioritizes quality, you know, top-notch content, I think retention will remain high, the RCS will grow. Big title releases that don't occur annually will mean that growth isn't exactly linear. But I do believe the moat will continue to widen, and the growth will continue to smooth out. All right, just quickly on the valuation, you know, I went through a pretty elaborate valuation process last time, and I would encourage you, if you're curious, to go back and look at that presentation from last year, you know, where I attempted to appraise Rockstar's value. This time I keep it pretty simple. You know, I think Take-Two is going to keep beating expectations. I think they're going to keep releasing incredible content. On the top, I'm taking a blended multiples approach. I'm assuming a couple big blockbuster releases in 22 and 23. That's what's driving the big EPS increase. And then I also do a formalized DCF. You know, I didn't want to go through all the inputs, but this is kind of a simplified valuation method that I feel is pretty defensible. It gets me to the same result. I'm just trying to annuitize everything, trying to build everything into one cash flow stream. And I kind of lay out my assumptions in the table there. So you're free to look at that. You know, one last note of valuation, and this is more about Intrepid, but we first started purchasing Take-Two in the low 90s. You know, we set intrinsic value targets, and then we revise our estimates as new information becomes available. So the $180 that you see here is today's intrinsic value estimate based on our probability weighted view of the future. You know, as new information becomes available, as certain things become more certain, that target can obviously change, and it goes both ways. Speaking of changing, you know, I should talk real quickly about the risks. You know, I haven't spent much time talking about them. There's obviously a lot of risks with any high growth company. You know, video games are discretionary spending. A lot of people thought if we had an economic shock that people would stop spending in video games. It's actually proven to hold up pretty well in recessionary environments. Video game spending, I remember during my research finding that during the Great Financial Crisis between 2008 and 2010, video game sales held up pretty well and actually grew. I mean, it could happen where people stop spending, but I think it's unlikely, just given what a cheap and good bang for your buck you get playing video games. We talked about the shifting monetization trends earlier. You know, if gamers decide that the free-to-play model is what they want, Take-Two may have to change the way that they operate. You know, in the past, Take-Two's had game delays and busts. Doesn't happen often, but it does happen, and it could happen again. You know, given how long the development cycles are, they generally do a pretty good job of quality control and try to have some degree of certainty when they release a game that the consumer demand will be there. But it's still subject to vicissitudes. You know, the market can be fickle. And, you know, there were murmurings of regulatory risk. I think it was late last year. Might have been a few months after I presented last time, but, you know, President Trump announced he was going to go after the video game publishers at one point. I remember that day because it drove all the publisher stocks down, you know, high single digits. And that's been talked about for years, you know, glorification of violence in video games, especially with, you know, sort of the tragic spate of shootings that we have regularly in the United States. You know, there have been talks about moderating some of the graphic imagery in video games. That could happen. That certainly wouldn't bode well for a game like Grand Theft Auto, but I think it's very unlikely. you know, other macro level possibilities, you know, like a recession, hard to avoid, but I do, you know, want to point back to what I mentioned a second ago about sales during the great financial crisis being positive. And, you know, worst case scenario, laid off portfolio managers can play video games and help the industry out with their newly acquired free time. So to conclude, take two, premium publisher of video game content, best in class IP. You know, we talked a lot about tailwinds to publishers, cheaper platform fees, increased penetration of video games across the world, and better ways to game that are going to just continue to bring on incremental gamers. You know, and lastly, conventionally speaking, you know, Take-Two isn't really a cheap stock by traditional valuation measures. We own a lot of deep value stocks at Intrepid, and I struggled initially with how to think about the valuation and how to justify it. But one thing I've learned is that it's usually better to pay up for a quality company than to pay down for a hand-me-down company. And I do think Take-Two is worth the premium and that it is a defensible valuation for what you're getting. And with that, I'm happy to answer some questions.
Well, Hunter, thank you so much for such a comprehensive presentation. You really have covered pretty much everything one could have on one's mind. You talked about the other two of the top three players as well, and kind of how the company here is catching up. What about Epic Games? I'm just wondering if you could talk just a little bit more about them, because they seem to have kind of come out of nowhere almost over the past decade or last few years. And if you could talk a little bit more about the trajectory that they're on in terms of mind share and market share.
That's a great question. Yeah, Epic has come out of nowhere. You know, they're a Cary, North Carolina-based publisher. I was actually up near Cary a couple weeks ago. I drove up to North Carolina to do some hiking, and it's a small town, probably best known before Epic for hosting a regional cross-country championship, kind of an obscure fact. But, you know, nestled in this small North Carolina town is probably the hottest video game developer in the world right now. And, you know, it was founded by an eccentric billionaire, you know, kind of has the hallmarks of you know, a video game company. A lot of these are founded by some characters. But, you know, they're really good at a lot of the same things Take-Two is good at. You know, they're really good at going where the puck is going. You know, they're really good at creating amazing, engrossing content. You know, they had a lot of help early on. You know, I don't remember all the details of the deal. You know, Epic's obviously still private, but Tencent made a pretty big investment early on that really helped Epic invest in the server space and the storage space to build out their offering quickly. You know, they weren't the first in the genre. They were the first to really popularize it, but another game called Public Underground is really the first battle royale that Fortnite then, you know, sort of built off of. And they really tapped sort of an under-penetrated demographic. You know, one of the things that surprised me the most when I did research on Fortnite is it really wasn't pulling players away from, you know, some of these other games that had similar mechanics like Call of Duty or, you know, on Take-Two side, Red Dead Redemption or Grand Theft Auto. You know, the average age was, you know, 15, 16. It was mainly kids who, you know, growing up, I would go shoot basketball with friends of mine. You know, the next generation, you know, would get together and do battle royales. That was kind of the thing that they would do. So it tapped into this market of new gamers who had not really become enamored with some of these traditional intellectual properties and really just struck gold at the right time. You know, and what I do think is interesting about Epic that makes them a little bit different than Take-Two is, you know, they've been really smart about intentionally positioning themselves on the distribution side. You know, I talked a lot about the Epic Game Store, and they also have a game engine that I could spend a whole nother hour talking about, that kind of linchpins a lot of the the popular titles that other games are built on, but the store, the Epic Games Store, you know, that gets that take rate benefit, has an Apple Store type effect, and that a lot of games are being sold through now because, you know, you bring all these players into the Fortnite ecosystem, and you know, Fortnite's one title. You know, gamers are eventually going to move on to something else, right? It might not happen for a decade, but you kind of have to set yourself up. You have to diversify a little bit. You know, it's like an investment manager with one product, right? You know, your product might go out of favor at some point, so you really need to be diversified. So, you know, they decided to go after this store where they could have other games made by other publishers and just be a middleman and capture those take rates. And they've been really successful doing that. You know, Take-Two's worked in concert with them, has had some exclusive releases on their store. Like I said, when they made Grand Theft Auto 5 free to download on the store, it actually crashed the store momentarily. So many people were trying to download it. And then another thing that they, you know, that they got access to was the Chinese market. You know, because of the Tencent connection, they've gotten access to a demographic that no one else has legally really been able to get access to, because the Epic Game Store is allowed in China. So a lot of tailwinds behind Epic. It's a fascinating company. A lot of investors in it now. I forget what round of fundraising they're on. You know, but a really interesting company and a lot to be learned from them. You know, I think Take-Two, you know, choosing to partner with them through their store really points to the fact that they are serious and that they are, you know, one of the bigger players. And at some point they probably will go public. And it'll be interesting to see how the market treats them, you know, vis-a-vis, you know, some of the other bigger publishers.
One comment you made that kind of struck me was, I think you said something like 7 years in this business is kind of like a century. I'm wondering how, you know, can you put that in the context of competitive advantage and the moat? Because it seems like change is happening pretty fast on a number of fronts. But what are maybe the things that don't change over time? And do you feel like the company is good at those things that won't change?
Yeah, that's an insightful question. I think you really sort of pointed the answer in your question. You know, it is about the things that don't change over time, those durable characteristics. And I would say it goes beyond video games. It's really content. What makes content endure? You know, what makes something so good that people revisit it over and over again, despite how quickly the world is changing, despite the fact that other things fall away and disintegrate, you know? What causes these things to hold up? And if you look at the franchises that have had that phenomenal success, and for Take-Two, it's certainly Grand Theft Auto, you know, Red Dead Redemption, to a lesser extent, you know, with Activision, that you could say it's World of Warcraft, you know, with EA, you could say it's the durability of some of their sports franchises or Sims, which continues to grow engagement. You know, I think what really underlies it is kind of complicated and psychological. You know, I think it's engaging narratives. You know, it's little things. It's fantastic music. It's fantastic relatable characters within the game, and it's an ecosystem where you can interact with other players, in a way that's timeless. You know, you can continue to explore areas of this virtual world with a group of friends that have familiarity but yet evolve, you know, and that's where I think the user-generated content aspect is really important. If you look at, you know, the common thread between a lot of those games, and I would say, you know, without being an expert on other sorts of content, is a common thread through a lot of successful content that endures through the ages, you know, it has the ability to grow on itself and to scale. You know, it has the ability to fit that battle cry of engagement, beginning engagement. So, you know, for something like Grand Theft Auto, you know, there's a lot of user-generated content. And what I mean by that is, you know, without getting too technical, you can actually create mods, you know, which are user-created worlds on top of the Grand Theft Auto world, you know, where you change certain aspects of the game and you can open that up for other players who can join your server. you know, another game that has endured kind of that century of video game year analogy I made is Minecraft, which has a similar adaptability where you can grow these worlds on top of the existing world. And I think that that's probably, if I had to point to anything, is probably the main ingredient that's helped keep people coming back to Grand Theft Auto. It's just the variability of the gameplay and you know, sort of the user-generated content that can evolve the gameplay over time. But it's a nuanced question. I mean, it's a good question. I'm sorry, I wish I could be more articulate addressing them. I'm kind of fascinated by it myself. But, you know, I think, you know, the proof is in the pudding. And someone like Take-Two has shown they can consistently generate these sorts of titles. You know, whether it was through Grand Theft Auto 5 or Red Dead Redemption 2 or some of the other games that have lasted much longer than the typical game lifespan of 6 months to a year. So yeah, no, that's a great question, John.
Well, thank you. That's really helpful. And maybe lastly, I always like to get into a capital allocation a little bit. I'm wondering how you view the likely evolution of their priorities on that front. Do you see inorganic growth, perhaps even going forward at all? And anything you might prioritize differently than the management is doing?
Yeah, another good question. So, you know, kind of the capital allocation priorities historically have been, you know, one, pumping money back into the business, and the returns on invested capital, you know, they're so good. And it's such a scalable business. It's such a cap light business. You know, and it's part of the reason that the shareholder returns over the past decade have been so phenomenal. So that's been priority number one. You know, there is a fair amount of dilution through the share-based comp when you remove that from sort of the free cash flow generation, it's a lot less. So I think a priority more recently has been, you know, share repurchases to kind of offset some of that dilution, although they don't, you know, nearly one for one offset it. I do think the war chest on the balance sheet, you know, the $2 billion of net cash, is probably earmarked for some sort of inorganic growth. You know, they waded in a little bit with the purchase of Social Point 3 years ago. I know that they've tried. They've made bids on various assets. But one thing I appreciate about Strauss and the management team is they're very disciplined capital allocators. You know, they really think about it the same way I think shareholders should think about it, which is, where is the highest and best priority from a return on this capital? You know, what's going to get me the highest and most consistent return on this capital? You know, not what's going to make me the biggest video game publisher, not, you know, what's going to, you know, glorify the company as much as possible. And, you know, it's really shareholder centric, the thinking on capital allocation priorities. So, you know, could they have bought certain publishers at 40 times earnings, you know, over the past 5 years? I'm certain they could have. I know for a fact they bid on certain things, and I know for a fact that a lot of those assets were sold at sky high valuations that are tough to make sense of. You know, one in particular, one sort of crown jewel studio that they've kind of circled is Bethesda, who makes a series called Fallout, very popular game series, Boston-based publisher, top-notch, similar in some respects to Rockstar. You know, I think management was hopeful that at some point, you know, the market might take a dip and multiples would contract and they'd have a chance to buy. Unfortunately, if anything, you know, the tragedy of COVID-19 has probably helped video game multiples, just because it's shown the durability of the business and, you know, engagements at all-time highs and people are playing video games like never before. You know, at some point in the future, will they have a stab at some inorganic asset or some inorganic growth? I think they probably will. And I think that it makes sense, you know, in a lot of ways. But, you know, right now there's so much white space organically, right? I talked about the margins, right? Still, you know, I think anywhere from 5 to 800 basis points behind the competitors on the EBITDA side, you know, and a lot of that's just operating leverage, right? Keeping your marketing and sales, level while you continue to grow your gross profit. You know, it's I think it's going to scale really nicely over the next 5 years as the top line continues to grow. And so I wouldn't expect any sort of inorganic growth, you know, absent a big dip in valuations. But I would like to see it at some point. And I'm very happy with the way they've allocated capital. You know, I think that management has a really concise plan laid out, and they followed it really well.
Well, Hunter, this has been really terrific. Thank you so much for preparing this presentation and sharing your thesis and your deep industry insights with our members. We truly appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely, John. I always enjoy chatting with you. And, you know, I put my contact information here. Seriously, some of the best conversations I had, you know, came from this presentation last year. I got a lot of really great feedback and learned a lot from some other members. So even if it's just a small comment or a question or a criticism, especially if it's a criticism, please reach out, because, you know, I really love learning this stuff and talking to others who may know something I don't. So, you know, please don't be a stranger.
Terrific. Well, I definitely encourage everyone listening to feel free to reach out. Thank you so much for showing the contact information here on the screen. Thanks again, Hunter.
Absolutely.
All the best, and goodbye for now.
Okay. Thanks, John.
Bye-bye.